the Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. We bring you Stephen Greenblatt this time. Although one of our nation's most revered Shakespeare scholars, Greenblatt's writing in no way resembles that of an academic. He is the author of two national bestsellers. Will in the World is a nonfiction retelling of Shakespeare's life and times that reads like a novel, and Swerve recounts the discovery of a poem and how it changed the course of modern history. The Swerve won both the Pulitzer and the National Book Award. Greenblatt has taught at Harvard since 1997, and before that he taught at Berkeley for almost 30 years. The author of 11 books and the editor of several others, including the Norton Shakespeare, Greenblatt's honors include two Guggenheims and a Mellon Distinguished Humanist Award. Greenblatt himself has said, "I'm very eager to make a large public aware that there was a past to which they remain in a compellingly interesting relation, that is, that this past continues to speak powerfully to them." It's a talk from 2013 on Portland Arts and Lectures. Here's Stephen Greenblatt.
Thank you all very, very much, ladies and gentlemen. I want to talk today about the way in which very dangerous ideas pass through the extremely tight mesh of scrutiny that, at least in the past, the ancient world, they received. And I want to start by looking at a quote from St. Augustine: "What death is worse for the soul than the freedom to err?" Because among the master builders of Christian orthodoxy, and Augustine in the late 4th and 5th century is the greatest of these masters, there was very little tolerance for toleration. Though they had themselves been ruthlessly persecuted, of course, once they were in power, Christians moved as quickly as they could to suppress rival systems of worship. And in doing so, they confirmed the charges that had led to the persecutions against them in the first place. That is to say, Christians could not, pagans argued, be treated in the way that the authorities in the Roman Republic and later in the Empire had ordinarily treated newly encountered religions. That is, Christianity could not and would not be assimilated, its reigning divinity aligned by sophisticated pagan intellectuals to the existing panoply of the gods. That's what intellectuals did in the Roman world for a living. They figured out how to take alien religions and make them part of their own panoply, and they couldn't do that with the Christians. Not only was Christianity monotheistic, that's problem one, and hence unwilling to acknowledge the existence of other gods, but it was also Catholic in the sense of universal. That is to say, it was committed to urging everyone to abandon their time-honored religious beliefs and practices. And a succession of Christian emperors, beginning with Theodosius the Great in 391 of the Christian era, issued edicts that forbade public sacrifices and started closing the major pagan cultic sites. The state had embarked on the destruction of paganism. It's true. Is it not true that we're dead and living only in appearance? This is a pagan poet, Palladius, asking in the wake of the destruction of the Temple of the Serapion in Alexandria. We Hellenes, fallen on disaster, likening life to a dream, since we remain alive while our way of life is dead and gone. From this point onward, Palladius intuited, his world would slide into the strange state of suspended animation, of living death, that is the fate of cultural relics. It's what it means to be in those endless rooms and museums where you see the traces of dead religions, dead cultures. Or for that matter, as I can experience living in Rome, what it means to look around you. To its monotheism and its universalism, Christianity conjoined a commitment to a single absolute doctrinal coherence that was alien to both pagan and Jewish religious traditions. In their disputes over points of interpretation, rabbis hurled fierce charges at one another. They were quite violent in their opposition. But their texts, the Midrash Rabbah, the Talmud in general, portions of which date from the time of Augustine, bear witness to something we could call an openness, that is to say, simply a lack of resolution an incoherence, even the possibility of coherence, that would have been unacceptable to the most ambitious Christian theologians. The spirit of the Talmud is obviously quite different from the spirit of pagan disputes, philosophical disputes, such as you find in Cicero and other ancient authors, but they're very similar, the Jews and the pagans in that regard, of leaving open lots of questions, of not thinking that you can finally resolve them. And indeed, of writing in the spirit that the historian of science, Bruno Latour, calls compositionism. St. Augustine set in motion the process that would lead away from compositionism to the dream of doctrinal absolutism, the search, which was never, of course, complete, for a theology that would not be what Latour calls fragile, revisable, and diverse, but unshakable, unchangeable, and coherent. And the motivation was not only a certain kind of philosophical ambition, a distaste for mess of the kind that a fragile or revisable compositional system has, but also a particular concern for the fate of the soul, for where you were going to wind up. Christian orthodoxy could not tolerate false beliefs, mistakes, errors, for the same reason that the state, as Thomas More put it centuries later, when at the end of his life More was engaged in the persecution of heretics, the state, he said, couldn't tolerate the sale of poisoned bread. So the fundamental care for the health and safety of those in your charge must commit you to protect them from grievous harm, from hurting themselves. And hence Augustine's question with which we began, what death is worse for the soul than the freedom to err? Now that question was posed in the early 5th century in the course of a debate with these people called the Donatists. They were one of many heretical groups. And it directs our attention to a particular feature of Christianity as it formed in its extraordinary and magnificent way in the early Middle Ages, which was that particularly intense persecutorial attention was paid not to the relics of vanquished beliefs, and not even to rival faiths, but to deviations, often very subtle, within the one true faith. The word heresy, as you might know, derives from the word hieresis, which means choice, making a choice, having choices to make. And it's precisely choice and the attendant idea that there might be multiple competing positions among which you could choose, that in the name of saving the soul, Christians determined not to allow. In its place was a single truth, and with it a determination to weed out false beliefs. For Augustine, who is the greatest of the early medieval intellectuals and an absolutely astonishing figure even today, the key biblical text was the parable of the wheat and the tares. I confess to you, I had to look up tares in the dictionary. It means darnel or vetch, the kind of stuff you don't want growing in your garden. The kingdom of heaven, Jesus tells his disciples in Matthew, is likened unto a man which sowed good seed in his field, but while men slept, his enemy came and sowed tares among the wheat and went his way. But when the blade was sprung up and brought forth fruit, then appeared the tares also. So the servants of the householder came and said unto him, Sir, didst thou not sow good seed in the field? From whence hath it tares? He said unto them, An enemy hath done this. The servants said unto him, Wilt thou then that we go and gather them up? But he said, Nay, lest while ye gather up the tares, ye root up also the wheat with them. Now, as I hope you can see, this would seem to be the least plausible text to advance in support of the vigorous persecution of heretics. To be sure, the tares didn't just spring up naturally. They were planted by an enemy. If they're bad to have in your garden, they might crowd out the life-sustaining crop. But the master, as you can see, explicitly tells the servants not to pull up the weeds for fear of destroying the wheat. So the argument seems like an argument for open discussion, for something like freedom of the press. But that's not at all Augustine's conclusion. In an influential interpretive move, And Augustine was a great intellectual, and this is the kind of thing intellectuals do professionally. He argues against what seems to be the surface implication of Jesus' words, that this parable, properly understood, licenses, encourages, even requires heresy hunting. The only reason, Augustine writes, that the master left the tares to grow until the harvest was the fear that uprooting them sooner would harm the grain. When this fear does not exist because it's evident which is the good seed, and when someone's crime is notorious and so execrable that it's indefensible, then it's right to use severe discipline against it. For the more perversity is corrected, the more carefully charity is safeguarded. So it's important in the interest of charity for one to act on the implicit understanding here, which is, after all, perfectly sensible. You don't to pull everything up that springs in the first few days in your garden because you don't know which is good and which is not good. But after it begins to grow, you have an idea and you can pull up the weeds. And it's at that point that Augustine invokes the closing words of Jesus's parable. And those closing words, in the context of what Augustine thinks that they mean, have a slightly chilling ring. "Let them both grow together," Jesus says, "until the harvest. And in the time of harvest, I will say to the reapers, gather ye together first the tares and bind them in bundles to burn them, but gather the wheat into my barn." The earlier admonition not to pull up the tares for fear of harming the wheat must not, in this account, be taken as a guide to the appropriate treatment of heretics. The appropriate treatment of heretics is suggested for Augustine, though it's extremely unlikely that Jesus was thinking along these lines, by those words, "bind them in bundles to burn them." When the full power of the state was mobilized in support of this fateful conjunction, which is deeply determinative of what happened in the centuries, as it were, leading up to our time, of monotheism, universal, and doctrinal absolutism, the consequence was the one that has been succinctly described by an historian, Perez Zagorin. "Of all the great world religions, past and present," Zagorin writes, "Christianity has been by far the most intolerant." Such a summary judgment doesn't describe the present in any way. And it cannot possibly describe, in fact, the day-to-day behavior of medieval and Renaissance Christians, even in the shadow of Augustine's words. That is to say, there's a massive historical scholarship now that has documented the practical accommodations that men and women routinely made to confessional differences within their communities and even inside families. Those differences could erupt from time to time into violent and bloody conflicts, but for the most part, they simmered quietly in an uneasy sort of way. But the principle was clear, which was that heresy was classified as a capital crime. And in the 13th century, Aquinas argued that it was a capital crime akin to forgery. And as Aquinas says, if the state can, and indeed does, go after forgers and execute them, it should, by rights, do so for heretics. Now, what you should understand is that these, because our own world is full of images of this kind, of usually of crazed, bearded people wanting to blow up Buddhas and do other things, it's hard to take in, as we should take in, that this is Aquinas and Augustine. These are the most intelligent, sensitive, intellectually complex, fantastically gifted people of their world. They're not merely ignorant zealots. They're trying to think of how to keep people from consuming poisoned bread. There are conflicting accounts of the process through the world, through which the world escaped this nightmare, insofar as it has escaped from it. And the Renaissance, the field that I'm most interested in, clearly played a significant part for a number of different reasons, because of the recovery of pagan antiquity, because of the impact of New World discoveries, the fact that people kept encountering huge parts of the world that had no notion of any of these doctrines, the slow growth of philosophical skepticism, the determination of secular rulers to get things a little quieter in their states, and finally, a widespread popular revulsion in the wake of religious wars. But as we know from our own world, it takes an amazingly long time for people to get exhausted from killing each other. And so these problems went on for a very long time. And the issues were by no means quickly resolved. And even the point at which you begin to see and can breathe a sigh of relief at their apparent resolution in the later 17th century, they're not resolved. John Locke's celebrated letter concerning toleration, which is really the text that in effect defines the world that we as Americans think that we live in and do in effect live in, was first published in Latin in the Netherlands in 1689, and it declared that the care, therefore, of every man's soul belongs unto himself and is to be left unto himself. But the problem is that even here, at what must be, by any reckoning, the moment of the beginning of modernity, the very end of the Renaissance, very few of Locke's contemporaries agreed, or at least were willing publicly to declare that they agreed with this prescription. That's one of the reasons this is published in Latin, in the Netherlands, and anonymously. Belief in one religion or another, Locke argued, could not be compelled, and dissent from one religion or another should not be punished. This is what he argued against the grain of his time. For all the life and power of true religion, he wrote, consists in the inward and full persuasion of the mind. And faith is not faith without believing. The church, therefore, he said, must be a free and voluntary society. I may grow rich by an art that I take not delight in. I may be cured of some disease by remedies that I have not faith in. But I cannot be saved by a religion that I distrust and by a worship that I abhor. And as for the claims of orthodoxy, Locke wrote in a wonderful phrase, everyone is orthodox unto himself. Now, as I say, it's crucial to grasp that even in the late 17th century in England, Protestant England, these views were widely and vehemently attacked as far beyond the pale of what was acceptable. And it's also important to grasp that Locke himself articulated a very significant exception. Those are not at all to be tolerated who deny the being of a God. So why is that? Why, if religion consists in the inward and full persuasion of the mind, should toleration not extend to those whose minds are unpersuaded? And Locke has an answer. He says that promises, covenants, and oaths, which are the bonds of human society, can have no hold upon an atheist. Now, the argument, which is one that is much repeated in this period and would have been absolutely, virtually universally accepted, is, as you can see, not a doctrinal one, but a social one. That is to say, it doesn't focus on the soul's eternal life, it focuses on the here and now. Though the state cannot forcibly compel specific forms of belief on individuals, Locke thought, the community has a legitimate interest in protecting itself. And that protection is particularly necessary against those who would threaten the very foundation of social exchange. The taking away of God, though but even in thought, Locke writes, dissolves all. And that's extraordinary, though but even in thought. So here at the very end of the English Renaissance and the beginning of the Enlightenment of our world, we find in the work of one of the most daring of its minds a clear limit to what can be tolerated. And what's striking about that to me is that Locke's position echoes almost exactly a position that was articulated 150 years earlier at the very beginning of the Renaissance by the great Catholic intellectual and writer Thomas More, whom I've already mentioned. And More tried to imagine what was the most remarkable tolerant regime conceivable. And he didn't think it was a real place. He called it utopia, no place. But it was a daring, a fantastically daring intellectual act, exercise in the year 1516. Eutopus, the founder of Utopia, rules that it should be lawful for every man to follow the religion of his choice, as long as he doesn't insist too violently upon it with others. But one position is emphatically not merely discouraged, but prohibited in Moore's imaginary world of extreme tolerance of a kind that would have been absolutely unimaginable anywhere in the early 16th century. The position is this, that Eutopus conscientiously ruled that No one should fall so far below the dignity of human nature as to believe that souls likewise perish with the body, or that the world is the mere sport of chance and not governed by divine providence. So Moore is much more explicit, actually clearer intellectually, I think, than Locke about what the absolute foundational principles would be. To be counted as citizens in the most tolerant of imaginary Renaissance states, utopians have to believe in post-mortem rewards and punishments, and they have to believe in providence. And if not, they'll be treated as subhuman and will be enslaved or killed. And Moore imagines what the answer should be as to why this should be in this perfect world, this no place where everything is good. He says, who can doubt that he will strive either to evade by craft the public laws of his country or to break them by violence in order to serve his private desires when he has nothing to fear but laws and no hope beyond the body? So the question conjures up in very clear terms the specter that haunts even the most radical Renaissance defenses of toleration. The ones, and we're looking in Moore and Locke at the extreme outer edge of what people, or what humans at that time could imagine as tolerable. We've reached the limit case, the point at which the implacable Catholic saint and the Protestant philosopher of the liberal Enlightenment meet in a mystic marriage. Okay, that's the, and it's important that I took the time to do this because this, you have to understand this is the background for everything I'm going to try to talk about now, which is what it means in this world, the world I've just described, for very disturbing ideas to come back. And how is it possible for those ideas to get through if this is the general conception of things? And the particular ideas I'm interested in are the ones that I've recently written about, the corpus of ancient materialist philosophy, atomism, the school of Democritus, Leucippus, and Epicurus, was almost completely lost, and its loss was not entirely accidental, partly accidental, but not entirely. And the answer for its loss has to do with the fact that paganism and Judaism and Christianity found quite a bit to admire in Plato and Aristotle, and they had a reason, therefore, to conserve at least some portions of those works. But atomism, the idea that the world consists of atoms and emptiness and nothing else, didn't arouse any comparable admiration. There was a weird moment in the fourth century of the Christian era in which, very, very brief, in which the Roman Empire had already gone after Constantine had become Christian, but there was a brief moment at which there was a pagan emperor who wanted to return Rome to paganism. And he drew up a reading list to try to teach people to be pagans again. And he said in that reading list, this is Julian, the famous Julian the Apostate, that he said in that reading list, let's not read anything by the Epicureans. And that would have been a position that Jews who Jews still call unbelievers apikoiros, Epicureans, and that would have been a position that Christians likewise would have cheerfully agreed upon. So virtually all of that world of ancient materialism was lost. And therefore it's more surprising, amazing in fact, that Lucretius's poem, De Rerum Natura, written around 50 before the Christian era, from which virtually everything we know about materialism comes, survived. That it did survive depended almost entirely on the vagaries of the medieval scriptorium, the monasteries where they used to copy books. Two moments were crucial. There was a moment in which a monk, whose name we don't know, requested permission, or more likely was assigned, to copy the 7,400 lines of this difficult Latin poem that otherwise would have perished along with so much else. And there, we don't know when this happened, but probably in the 8th century, possibly early 9th century. And there was a moment in 1417 in which the papal bureaucrat and humanist book hunter Poggio Bracciolini found the manuscript in a monastic library, probably in Germany, had a copy made, sent the copy to his friend and fellow humanist Niccolò Niccoli in Florence. Poggio Bracciolini was famous for having unbelievably beautiful handwriting. There's a sample of it. And he sent it to his friend He didn't copy it himself. He didn't have time to do it, but he sent it to his friend Niccolò Niccoli to copy it. And there's Niccolò Niccoli also had quite good handwriting. And there's his copy. Now, the central propositions of this poem, De Rerum Natura, on the nature of things, that the world consists of atoms and emptiness and nothing else, that in itself was certainly not the view of Poggio's world, but the idea that the world consists of atoms, little tiny things, wouldn't have flabbergasted people in the Middle Ages because they knew that such a theory existed. No one was prepared, however, for the full implications of the interlocking argument when it came back in this one remarkable text. For Lucretius argued not only that there were atoms and emptiness in the world, but that there was nothing else. There were no demons, there were no angels, there were no ghosts, and there were no bodiless, immaterial souls. And what followed, as the poem winds its way through its magnificent six books, was a succession of unacceptable propositions of the kind that gave Moore and Locke and all of their contemporaries very, very bad stomach aches. Let us just quickly rehearse a few of the propositions that would have been particularly upsetting in this period. First of all, Lucretius argued, Epicureans argued, that the universe has no creator or designer. The particles themselves have not been made, and they cannot be destroyed. And the problem with this claim is not only that the notion that the universe, the matter of the universe, was uncreated and immortal, but that nature functions without divine control or design. They would have had ways of dealing with the idea that the matter might last forever, although they wouldn't have believed it, but they were able to process that claim by thinking about Aristotle, but that there was no design, ipsa sua per se sponte, that just happens by itself. That was completely unacceptable. Secondly, nature ceaselessly and randomly experiments. Holy Scripture was understood to state very clearly that all the species on earth were created by God in the first days. Of course, mutations were observed, but they were not part of an ongoing, evolving life process. That is to say, people in subsequent centuries knew that there were monsters that were born, two-headed babies, lambs with five legs, people with six fingers, and so forth, of the kind of thing that Lucretius also remarks. But for Lucretius, it's how things come about. It's an ongoing process of mutation. And that's how species come to be in the world. And moreover, Lucretius claimed that nothing is born in us simply in order that we may use it, but that which is born creates the use. Now, I don't know if you can get just in a moment from looking at this how radical and disturbing that claim is if you believe in providence. And it's actually very difficult for us to get. Very few, if you did a survey, very few of our contemporaries would grasp or concede this principle, because it includes arguing that you don't get eyes in order to see. The eyes don't come into being in order to let you see. The eyes come into being, Lucretius thought, because there was a peculiar mutation. And if the mutation turned out to be good to enable you to find food and reproduce, then that mutation would be successful. But it didn't come about because someone thought it would be nice for you to see. And as I say, I know this is the principle that evolutionary biologists believe, and I believe in it too, in the kind of religious orthodoxy of modernity. But I have very great difficulty getting my head around it as a principle. The world, Lucretius argued, was not created for or about humans. There was no original paradisal state designed to make human beings feel at home. As a species, you make your way through a universe that's hostile, and we're intensely vulnerable. We're like a baby is like a shipwrecked sailor, he says, flung up upon a beach, lying on the ground, naked, speechless, and helpless. Early humans were extremely primitive, he thought. They were not created, as some of the pagan myths of origin suggested, erect, standing up, and ready to go. They began as incredibly crude and primitive beings and only slowly evolved toward whatever civilization that we have. And the fate of the entire species, let alone that of any individual, is not the pole around anything at which anything resolves. And there's absolutely no reason to believe that our species will last forever. On the contrary, other species that no longer exist existed in the world before us, and other species will come to be after we cease to exist. That's the nature of the mutations of matter, he thought. And humans are not unique. It sounds at first perfectly acceptable to say that humans are not unique, that we're made up out of the things that the stars, for example, are made up. We're sprung from celestial seed. But actually, that's not good news from the point of view of orthodoxy. It means that we're made up out of the same stuff that this table is made up out of, or the sea is made up out of, or celestial orbs are made up out of. Just the same matter that everything else comes from. There's no special stuff that makes us human. All that we need to know is that we're organic beings that try to reproduce and survive. And then when we cease to survive, the soul dies along with the body. Lucretius thought the soul is made up out of material, very, very fine material that would come apart the way the material of our body, the coarser material of our body comes apart when we die. Life on earth is all that human beings have. And when our bodies die, our souls die as well, and they can't be reconstituted. And therefore, the Epicureans, Lucretius argued, all organized religions are superstitious delusions. Humans project their desires onto imaginary creatures whom they think are going to respond to them, and they get trapped in their false beliefs. Above all, they get frightened. They get frightened, especially by earthquakes and by lightning and thunder. And Lucretius argued that there are natural explanations for these things. His natural explanations seem to us quite absurd. And he himself would have accepted that idea because he said he's not sure these are the explanations, but he thinks there must be explanations in nature. It's not that someone is throwing something at us. The horrors that we imagine in the afterlife are actually things that we do in this life to people and not things that will await us after we're gone. And therefore, he thought the structure of religions was invariably cruel. They always promise hope and love, but their underlying structure, he thought, was based on anxiety and retribution. Believers are conditioned to worry about impiety, but it's belief that's the problem, he thought. And the real problem, he believed, with religions was that they always circle back to the idea of sacrificing children. He's thinking of Agamemnon and Iphigenia, I think. He's writing in 50 before the Christian era. But he had this strange idea that's the myth that is usually at the very center of religious belief, and that it's part of the wretchedness of human beings, that they would want to think that way. They'd want to think about sacrificing a child for religious purposes. On the contrary, he believed the highest goal of life is the enhancement of pleasure and the reduction of pain. Life should be organized to serve the pursuit of happiness. There's no higher ethical purpose than facilitating this pursuit for oneself and one's fellow creatures, and by fellow creatures he would include turtles and ducks and cows. That is to say, he didn't think we were so special that we only have pleasure and other creatures in the world shouldn't have pleasure. All other claims, service of the state, glorification of the gods or the rulers, arduous pursuit of virtue through self-sacrifice, are secondary or misguided or fraudulent. As you can probably get, this was quite unacceptable to most people in the Roman world. Lucretius actually found the militarism of the Roman world and their taste for violent sports and the Colosseum and so forth disgusting and unnatural. He thought that man's natural needs were quite simple. A failure to recognize the boundaries of those needs, how little you actually need to be happy, leads human beings to a vain and fruitless struggle for more and more and more. He was fascinated and appalled at the same time by the fact that people don't ever seem to want to stop. If they have 1 billion sesterces, they want 2 billion sesterces. If they control one city, they want to control 500 cities. They never feel like they've had enough. Now, all of these propositions were countercultural, as it were, already in the first century before the Christian era, and they would have seemed absolutely scandalous, horrifying to the early 15th century. The early 15th century were heirs to a rich, centuries-old culture that worshipped an omnipotent, omniscient creator god, that celebrated spiritual transcendence, that constantly reminded itself of the atoning value of pain and suffering and renunciation. And the fact that Lucretius's poem and the whole discourse that I've just very, very quickly described had completely disappeared made its sudden resurgence in the year 1417 seem as if a spaceship had come down, bringing utterly bizarre and disturbing ideas. Plato and Aristotle and Cicero were also discovered during this period, but parts of their works had been around for a long time and people had adjusted to them. In the case of Lucretius, there were 1,000 years of silence and then this returned. Much of what he said, much of what I've just articulated for you, seemed to all but a very few of Poggio Bracciolini's contemporaries impious, unbelievable, or simply incomprehensible. The most brilliant philosophical mind of this age, a Florentine philosopher named Marsilio Ficino, began a commentary upon this poem shortly after it was found and recirculated, and then he took in where it was leading him, and he burned the commentary. So the return of this poem in 1417 is a very radical moment. A tiny number of figures made forays into the intellectual territory that had opened. And what I'm showing you on the screen is a painting by a Florentine painter of the 15th century, a very weird painter named Piero di Cosimo, who was in the circle around the Medici. There are a few paintings that survive of Piero di Cosimo in which it's clear that he's thinking about this poem, though it's only clear if you have studied the poem and think about it. This is a forest fire in the ancient, as he imagines it. He's imagining primitive civilizations. And here is a hunt in which there are creatures who are not fully human, who are only in the midst of, as he would have imagined it, evolving toward humanity, who are hunting. And what that these paintings suggest, we don't know much about the circle because they were very careful and very quiet. But what the painting suggests is that a small number of people were interested in this poem, and particularly in the ideas about evolution that the poem was bringing back into the world. But they were careful, and we know very little about what they were saying. They were exceptions to formal and informal mechanisms of aversion and repression. Now, the simple existence of unacceptable or even outrageous ideas from the defunct pagan past wasn't so much the problem, because the Catholic Church of the Middle Ages and the Renaissance was not, how shall we say, the Taliban, simply bent on wiping off from the face of the earth everything that didn't square with its vision of the truth. Within its own reasonably capacious boundaries, medieval intellectuals had long enjoyed exceptional vitality, and after all, what lay outside those boundaries was preserved by the church, by copying over the text. The concern was that poison bread concern, infection by something. A risk that was greatly intensified by the fact that when the poem came back, it was beautiful. That was the problem. It's incredibly beautiful and seductive. Therefore, the question, as Ficino understood, the guy who wrote the commentary and then burned it, was proximity. How wise was it to get close to the poem? How close could you get without getting burned or infected? How safe was it to handle these radioactive materials? And for the better part of 2 centuries, the reception of Lucretius was a fugitive one that mingled aversion and anxiety, concealment, and then some kind of fascination. So that's what I'm, in the time, the few minutes that remain, I want to talk about. There's a 200-year period between, roughly 200 years between 1417, when the text was recovered after 1,000 years of loss, and There's a 200-year period between that and the first moment, in effect, that someone comes forward and says, yes, I believe these things. I believe in an infinite universe, in the ceaseless recombination of matter, in the absence of providential design, in the possible evolution of species and other distinctly Lucretian features. And that was this man, Giordano Bruno. And for his efforts, Bruno was imprisoned and interrogated. And what you're looking at is the statue in Rome in the Campo di Fiori that was built on the spot where in 1600 Bruno was burned at the stake. Even in 1600, obviously, 200 years later, it was not at all safe to get too close to these materials. And that time lag, the time lag before the first slightly crazy person comes forward and says, you know, I think these things are true, is what is fascinating. Because for decades and decades after the poem came back, no prudent person stepped forward and said, I think the world is only atoms and void, and that in body and soul were only fantastically complex structures of atoms linked for a time and then destined to come apart. No respectable citizen openly said, the soul dies with the body. There's no judgment after death. The universe wasn't created for us by a providential divine power, and the whole notion of the afterlife is a superstitious fantasy. And besides, if you actually think about the way life is, it couldn't have been designed by anyone who was remotely competent. No one who wished to live in peace stood up in public and said, the preachers who tell us to cower in fear and trembling are lying to us. God has no interest in our actions, and though I see that nature is beautiful and intricate, it's not the product of an overarching intelligent design. What should matter to us is the pursuit of pleasure, for pleasure must be the highest value of existence. These propositions were for the entire Renaissance entirely unacceptable, intolerable. But the poem survived and was allowed to circulate, so that's the question. How was the intolerable tolerated? And there are three answers, which I will, in the few minutes that remain, just briefly sketch, because I think they're quite interesting. The first answer has to do with the way people read, with readily strategies of avoidance. People read in lots of different ways. They took notes. This is actually the poet Ben Jonson's copy of Lucretius's poem, which is in the library at Harvard, in the Houghton Library. Jonson was a notorious drunk, and he must have spilled acid on the book one night when he was trying to make ink. They used to make ink out of acid, and he probably said, you know, oh, wipe the acid off, and went on. But that is what we have of the book now. And these books are, the early manuscripts and the early printed books are filled, as books from this period are, with little commentaries in the margin, so you can see how people were reading. And what you discover when you look carefully at how people were reading in the early years is that they tended to avoid remarks on any of the things that I showed you before. There's almost no marginal notes in the side of almost any of the passages that I put on the screen. Maybe that was caution, but maybe it wasn't caution. It was just what people were interested in. They made remarks on very fine points of Latin and Greek vocabulary. They speculated on questions of scansion in Latin poetry. They took notes on the weather or on Roman culture. They may just have been worrying about who might be looking over their shoulders, but I think actually more often than not, their eyes simply slipped over those passages in conscious or unconscious avoidance of something that they would find disagreeable or weird or merely foolish. And of course, we do this all the time, that lots of things right now are passing, as it were, before us in the newspapers and the internet or whatever, that may in fact be quite crucially important, but that we don't register. Simply goes under the radar. The second answer that's related to this first has to do with a practice that is very rarely given credit for the history of the development of toleration, and that is scholarship. What you're looking at here is what happens when scholars get to work on an ancient poem. What you're seeing in this very early 16th century printed text done for a school use is is that those two spaces up at the top are two lines of Lucretius's poem, and the rest of it is commentary. And that's how the whole text works. That's what scholars the likes of me do for a living. So what that is not calling a world back to life. It's not a form of resurrection of dangerous ideas. It's creating a support system, a very elaborate support system designed to surround the body of the text and to contain it and to keep it slowly breathing, but not doing anything else, not really speaking. So with the assistance of works like this, the poem De Rerum Natura was on its way to becoming a school text, a staple in the curriculum. And school teachers in the late 15th and 16th century loved this poem. They loved the poem because it's very difficult, really difficult, Latin. And it was an incredible excuse to beat students, which is the way, as you probably know, that Latin was taught, and probably the only way successfully that Latin is ever taught, even now. This text was very, and that's why a publisher spent a lot of money to make a text of this kind. And it was only in December 1516, almost a full century after Poggio discovered the text and returned it to circulation, that a Florentine synod, a high-ranking group of clergymen, actually looked carefully at it and said, "Are we crazy? What are we doing here? This is a text that is lascivious and wicked, that is teaching the mortality of the soul." And they said that they could no longer teach it in schools, and that violators of the edict were threatened with eternal damnation and a fine of 10 ducats. And it ruined the poor publisher who created texts like that. But if complete suppression proved impossible, as it did, because the problem is that once you get things in print, it's actually fairly easy to keep things under control in a manuscript culture, because you kill a certain relatively small number of people and you can at least slow down the circulation of texts. But once things get in print, it's much harder to stop them, even if you ban the teaching of books in school and so forth. It became fantastically difficult to slow the process down, but you could at least do certain things to diminish the bad effect. One of the things you could do was to make sure that the text that came out in print, and text did continue to come out in print, contained disclaimers or consumer warnings. Don't try this at home, in effect. And that's what for example, this wonderful French, 16th century French edition by Denis Lambin, came out in 1563, does. It says that the poem is alien to our religion because of its beliefs. It's got repellent and hateful ideas in it, but it is no less, he writes, a poem. Once a distinction is drawn between the work's beliefs, its content, and its artistic merit, the full force of the merit can be safely acknowledged. And Lambin says, merely a poem? Rather, it's an elegant poem, a magnificent poem. What about the content of the poem, he says? These insane and frenzied ideas, these absurdities about atoms and about innumerable worlds. He said, it's okay. Christians don't have to worry. Neither is it difficult for us to refute them, nor indeed is it necessary, because they're refuted anyway by the words of truth, that is to say, by Scripture, or, he says, by everyone remaining silent about them. So just be quiet about what it's contained, but enjoy it as a poem. Now, at least one of the early readers of this wonderful edition, Michel de Montaigne, couldn't remain silent. This is Montaigne's copy of Lucretius's, and you can see it's covered all the way through with Montaigne's comments. And Montaigne keeps quoting Lucretius in his essays. But Montaigne takes the warning, in effect, the advice, not in this case to be silent about it, but to treat the poem as a poem. One of the most extensive and remarkable parts of Montaigne's essays, in which he comments on Lucretius, is in a great essay of Montaigne that's on sexual intercourse. He gives it a very careful title of this essay. It's one of the great erotic essays of the 16th century, but he calls it On Some Verses of Virgil. And in the course of it, he quotes Lucretius's remarkable, famous description of sexual intercourse. In Lucretius, the poet Yeats said it's the greatest description of sexual intercourse ever written. And he just talks about how incredible the Latin is. When I ruminate that reicit, pascit, ineans, moli, fovit, medullus, labefacta, pendit, percurit, and that noble circumfusa, mother of the pretty infusus, I despise these petty conceits and verbal tricks that have sprung up since. Okay. Now, as you can tell, the appreciation of Lucretius depended on the possession of very good Latin, and Montaigne had fabulous Latin, and that meant that the poem's circulation was limited to a relatively small and elite group. And it's not an accident that more than 200 years passed after Poggio's discovery in 1417 before an attempt was made to translate the poem into a vernacular language. There were very strong disincentives to doing so. But eventually, by the 17th century, it grew, the interest grew too intense. And so the beginnings, there's a translation that's lost now that was done by Molière, the great playwright in France. There was a translation done in Italian, but the church kept it from appearing in print for a very, very long time, for centuries. There was an early translation of a single book in English, but it's not until 1682, more than 250 years after the recovery of the manuscript, that a complete English translation was published by a young Oxford-educated scholar, Thomas Creech, who committed suicide, poor man, not so long after he published it. Creech's Lucretius was greeted as an astonishing achievement when it appeared in print. But in fact, an English translation not in print had already been in limited circulation and from a very surprising source, from this person, Lucy Hutchinson, who was a Puritan, the wife of Colonel John Hutchinson, who was a parliamentarian and a regicide, that is to say, one of the people responsible for the execution of Charles I. So what's striking about this, and what I want to point out to you for just a moment about Lucy Hutchinson, is by the time she finished her translation, she hated everything it was saying. She claimed that she hoped its principles would vanish forever from the face of the earth. So why, when she thought that all of this wickedness should disappear, did she prepare a verse translation, prepare a professional scribe to write out the first five books, and carefully copy out book six and the rest of it in her own hand? And her answer is a fascinating one. She says that she hadn't initially realized how dangerous this text was. She undertook it out of youthful curiosity to understand things I heard so much discourse of at second hand. I find that remark tremendously revealing because it fills in a hole, a black hole. They were talking about this poem in the other room. The men were talking about it quietly. And she wanted to know what the poem was about. And she was good. She was incredibly smart. And she had good Latin. And she learned how to do this work and translate to find out what the poem was saying, what the men in the other room were talking about. But then why, once she had satisfied her curiosity, did she not simply burn what she had found? Because she was proud of herself as a poet. And she was proud of herself as a woman poet. I turned it into English in a room where my children practiced the several qualities they were taught with their tutors. And I numbered the syllables of my translation. This is a poetic translation. She was counting syllables by the threads of the canvas that I wrought in. She's a woman doing needlework and translating Lucretius at the same moment. And I set them down with a pen and ink that stood by me. She's responding as a poet, and she wasn't embarrassed to do so. And she gives a little backward glance at the very self-important English, the English writer John Evelyn, who had published a single book, a masculine witch, she says, published only a single book of the difficult poem and thought it worth printing his head in a laurel crown. The laurel crown is the key element to the survival and the transmission of what was perceived by Hutchinson and virtually everyone else in her world is intolerable. And that's my third and crucial point, which is that the thought police were only very, very rarely called in the Middle Ages and in the Renaissance to investigate works of art for their heretical implications. It wasn't only a matter of formal censorship, though it was a very important matter of formal censorship. It means that the artists themselves, many of whom thought of themselves, as Lucy Hutchinson certainly did, as very good Christians, as indeed she was, nonetheless could allow themselves a license to do this work. And the interesting thing is that the poet Lucretius already anticipated this effect. Epicurus, his philosophical master, he's a disciple of Epicurus, thought that philosophy should be written in prose. One of the very few things that survives, a saying that survives from Epicurus, as I say, almost all of Epicurus is lost, but one of the few sayings that survives is, "I spit on poetry." But Lucretius, the passionate disciple of Epicurus, puts the whole thing into a poem. Why? Because he says that it's the way in which physicians, when they want to trick someone into drinking what they might not otherwise drink because it's too unpleasant in taste, smear honey around the lip of a cup. And that survival, art is linked to survival. Art is linked to the possibility that you might get it down. The survival points to a further power in Lucretius's art. The realization that the universe consists of atoms and emptiness and nothing else, that the world wasn't made for us by a providential creator, that we're not the center of the universe, that we're not all that different from other animals. The realization of the nature of things, the real way things are, Lucretius thought, shouldn't bring with itself only bitterness, only cold emptiness, as if the universe had been robbed of its magic. It should bring with it the possibility of pleasure, of wonder, of sweetness. It shouldn't be only the illusion mongers, the priests, as he thought, in his world, who can give you some sense of the sweetness of life. With the aid of poetry, the actual nature of the way things are, an infinite number of indestructible particles swerving into one another, bouncing off each other, linking together, coming to life, coming apart, reproducing, dying, recreating themselves, forming an astonishing, constantly changing universe, can be depicted in its true splendor. Human beings must not drink in the poisonous belief that they're only part of the world for a moment and then they're going to go on to some other place. Because believing that means that they're not going to be nice to themselves and the place that they're in, that they'll treat the universe, the world, which is the only world that they have, in a disrespectful way. They have to understand that their lives and the lives of everything around them are contingent and vulnerable, that everything will eventually dissolve, but that while we're still alive, we should cultivate, we should fill our lives and the lives of everything around us with the deepest pleasure. For we're a small part of a vast process of world making that Lucretius celebrated as essentially erotic. And it's because he celebrated it as erotic that he does something very weird. This is a poet who thought that the gods could not possibly be interested in anything we have to say, that it's absurd to pray to them, to speak to them, to imagine that they would hear you. But this is a poet who writes the most beautiful hymn to a god, in this case a goddess, that comes from the ancient world. And this is the opening hymn to Venus, the prayer to Venus in De Rerum Natura. We don't know what the German monks who copied these verses in the 8th century made of them. We don't know what Poggio Bracciolini, who must have read them before he circulated them, thought that they meant. Certainly, almost every one of the poem's key principles was an abomination to right-minded people. But the poetry was compulsively, seductively beautiful. And we can see with great vividness what various people, artists, made of them. We can see for a moment, and as I bring us to a close, what one great English poet, a poet of very strong, impeccable Protestant convictions, made of them. This is The Faerie Queen by the great Protestant poet Edmund Spenser, contemporary of Shakespeare's. "Great Venus, queen of beauty and of grace, the joy of gods and men, that under sky dost fairest shine and most adorn thy place, that with thy smiling look dost pacify the raging seas and makes the storms to fly. Thee, goddess, thee the winds, the clouds do fear, and when thou spreadst thy mantle forth on high, the waters play and pleasant lands appear, and heavens laugh, and all the world shows joyous cheer. And as you can see, those of you who have Latin can see, this is just a direct translation of the Latin lines, and it goes on for verse after verse. It's not announced as Lucretius. It's just absorbed into the poem because it's so beautiful. This ecstatic hymn to the pagan goddess of love is not an expression of toleration in any sense that Spencer or Thomas More or Locke would have understood or accepted. Toleration, in any case, would not have been extended by someone like Spencer to the key ideas articulated in De Rerum Natura. What occurred instead of toleration in the Renaissance was what was done by artists, by artistic appropriation. And the appropriation was made possible by that homeostatic prolongation of the ancient work of art provided by humanist scholarship. But in the scholarly editions, the work was simply cadaverous and silent. It came alive only in moments such as the one that you've just glimpsed in Spencer, a brilliant stitching of the alien thing into a new body, and in that sense, a giving of it, of life. And so perhaps to the term homeostasis, which is keeping it alive in a state of equilibrium, I should, in closing, adduce a further medical marvel, one still stranger than the ability to keep a dead man breathing. We could call the art of artistic stitching, such as the one you've just seen in Spencer, an allograft, a graft between individuals of the same species. I was offered one a couple of years ago when I ruptured my Achilles tendon. The orthopedist offered me the Achilles tendon of a dead person. I refused because I had another tendon in my toe I could use, but still, they do this all the time. They take someone else's body and they put it inside yours. But the Renaissance wouldn't have been comfortable with this example of the allograft because they thought that the pagans were not fully like them. So they would have preferred calling it something like a xenograft, which we also do. That is to say, taking another species, like a monkey or a pig, and taking that into you. A piece of an ancient pagan poet, a poem, was cut out, kept alive, and incorporated into a living work of art. The great Renaissance creators, the Spencer of the Hymn to Venus, or the Shakespeare of the Queen Mab speech in Romeo and Juliet, which is saturated with Lucretius, or the Botticelli of the Primavera, which is an illustration of lines from Lucretius. These were the masters, not of tolerance in our sense, but of the life-saving, the idea-saving art of the cultural xenograft. And the organs that they so deftly harvested and preserved and transplanted continue to live in us, in me, and in you today. Thank you very much for a lot of attention. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. You're very, very kind, and you are most of all very, very patient. I kept you here a long time. The Germans have a word, Sitzfleisch. For people who are able to sit for a long time on their Fleisch. And I'm grateful to you for doing so.
You've been listening to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. That was Stephen Greenblatt. He spoke at Portland Arts and Lectures in 2013. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for The Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear this or any other talk in the series, visit literary-arts.org. Crystal Liguori produces the Archive Project for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community without whom this show would not be possible. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.